With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedy-ad-free. That's amazon.com/comedy-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey guys, you ever wonder what Phil and I wear while we podcast? You can find out if you join our Patreon. We'll also be talking about the films of 1989, but that's definitely less important than seeing our Zoom backgrounds, our headphone choices, and our sweatshirts.
It's true. It's true. You'll get to see all the various pieces of artwork that I have framed on my office wall, and you can see Kenny's garden, sort of. So that's something. That's exciting.
It's a hanging garden.
It's a hanging garden. But perhaps more important than anything, we are doing this Patreon to cover the best films of 1989. Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, with amazing guests like Tom Meissen, Liz Hanna, Joanna Robinson, Brian Cogman, Chuck Hayward. You can sign up at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. And for $5, you'll get access to all the audio of these fantastic episodes. For a few bucks more, you'll get video as well of our 99 and 89 episodes. And perhaps, most importantly, you'll be supporting us so we can just keep making podcast content for you guys.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the sequel franchise reboots of the films of 1999 at the behest of our parent company, Warner Brothers. Hat tipped Emily Vanderwerf here in 2022. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybar.
And I'm Phil Isco.
And as I just mentioned, with us is the queen of the Matrix and also the arbiter of all things. All things Christmas adjacent, Emily Vanderwerf. Thank you for coming back.
Hello, boys. you know, I used to be on this show like five times a year, and now it's down to like once a year, and I don't know how I feel about that.
Don't you worry. You're going to be back a couple times this year.
Oh, good. Good for me.
We've got some good stuff planned.
Yeah. I think we have a great Christmas adjacent movie for you. It's called Miracle on 34th Street. So I'm looking for. Yeah. What is going on?
How is Santa Claus?
Here's my question. Mm-hmm. Before we get into the Matrix, Emily and her wife Libby just did a screen dress on Christmas adjacent movies, and Emily played It's a Wonderful Life. Number one, which was vetoed by Libby. My question to you is, Emily, how is that working out for you?
how is what working out for me? The fact that I made a bold and iconoclastic choice that was the right one for America and that it was filibustered away. I'm feeling a lot. I asked that without judgment, but
I've noticed that there is a pretty significant backlash. That's what I'm asking.
Oh, I mean, Sure, but you know what? You got to make bold choices for America.
It's true.
To like move forward into the new era of the 21st century. We are working with 20th century ideas, and we need to move forward.
That's right.
And we need to let go of the past and understand that some of our understanding about the past is different. Now, I truly believe...
Wouldn't that be a great segue to Lana Wachowski's Matrix Resurrection?
Yes, but also, I truly believe that if It's a Wonderful Life were not a movie that had become shown at Christmas every year,
yeah,
my argument would be greeted a lot more favorably. That said, I get why people turned on me, including my own wife. But that's okay. That's okay. You know? So our marriage is fine and we're all happy and doing great.
It was a great episode of Screen Draft. It really, really was.
Welcome to the club.
I will say too, like, you know, I appreciated that you guys and Kenny and I, you know, we've been on Screen Draft a couple of times, and I think that we try to do the same thing, which is, you know, zig where people think you're going to zag and don't mm-hmm. put your predictable choices on there. As much as I love Eyes Wide Shut and Batman Returns, I understand the choices to not go with
picks. Eyes Wide Shut was one.
Yeah. Eyes Wide Shut made it on.
I just mean in general.
Yeah. Was an excellent Batman Returns. Number one choice. Yeah.
And like, I love that movie. I think it's a great number one choice. I mostly did it to spite my wife.
the trepidation and the feeling like I had this sense that she was just standing on the railroad tracks the entire podcast, knowing that this great George Bailey train was bearing down on her from two towns away, though. But she could hear it. And she knew it was coming, and she couldn't get off the tracks.
And the thing is, she could have played it at any time, and she knew I was going to have to accept it because I had made that argument to her so many times. And yet, she just sat there and waited for it to happen because she loves Rocky IV that much, apparently.
Good film.
Rocky IV is a good film. It's a good movie.
Rocky IV is amazing.
There's a robot. All Rockies are kind of Christmas adjacent in their own weird way. I just watched the original, which is kind of Christmas adjacent-y. But like that fight takes place in like December, I think. Like there are Christmas lights up all around the city. Okay, here's what I wanted. Here's how I wanted to start this conversation.
Yeah, please.
After you did Matrix 1 on this podcast, mm-hmm. you have become, not because of our podcast, though, you know, definitely partially, the indisputed oracle, as Phil said, of all things Matrix on the internet. This has led to, my understanding, 400 to 500 podcast appearances about this new movie.
Yes. Okay.
How can we be different?
That's a good question.
Actually, I've only been on one to actually talk about the new movie, and it was the Slate spoiler special. What would happen is I would get invited to be on a show, mm-hmm. and they would say, "We want to talk with you about the Matrix," and I would be like, "It's because I'm trans, right?" And then like I would get in there, and they'd be like, "So the Matrix is a trans allegory, correct?" And I was like, "Well, you can read trans themes into it, but I believe it's a larger thing than that." And then we'd have a nice conversation. But it was definitely, you know, reading the Matrix is one thing, and like that bugs me. This movie's more rich than that. That said, there's, you know, I actually think there's an interesting section in the Matrix Resurrections where all the characters are like, "Well, now what's the Matrix about?" Yes. And like they throw all these ideas out, including trans readings and, you know, fascist readings, and like it is sort of thrown out.
They
as
came
like,
back to back.
Yeah. It is sort of thrown out as like you can read all of this as you want, but it doesn't explain. It doesn't explain the Matrix. So, but this is only the second show I've been on talking about the new movie. It was generally it was just shows talking about the old movies and then having me say, "Have you seen the new movie?" And I'd say, "Yes, I really liked it." And then like we couldn't say anything more about it. And of course, as we know, America was once again gripped by Matrix fever. It was a huge hit and made $700 million one day.
Gripped by Matrix fever.
I want to piggyback on what you just said about how this movie can be read so many different ways. And I don't even mean this movie, but this franchise. Like, there are innumerable, and we're going to get into the ways that this franchise is brilliant. But I do think that part of what appeals to the three of us about this franchise is the myriad of ways that it can be interpreted. Like, I think that that's what one of the many things that is brilliant about it. Like, I don't know. I feel like it's a little myopic to kind of come at it in only one reading. And I will be completely frank. When we did our podcast a few years ago on The Matrix with you, you know, the trans allegory or the trans reading of the film to me personally was relatively new. It wasn't as though and I think part of it had to do with, you know, Lana and Lily's transition and what have you. But still, I do feel like, I don't know that, and I read your article again yesterday that you did about this film, the Vox article about trauma. Mm-hmm. And I really believe that this film is much more, is talking about a lot of other things outside of the trans thing. Like, I almost feel like the trans thing is kind of old hat to them, quote unquote. Like, on some level, it feels like they want to dive into all sorts of other interesting ideas. Yeah. What do you like? I don't know that this would be. Do you think this is the least trans, quote unquote, of the franchise in its own way, or
it's the most and the least? Like, it is very obsessed with tearing down binaries, which is of course part of the general project of transness, but. You know, it's also very interested in the ways that you spread that out to things like economic systems, political systems, etc. Right. And like, at the same time, you know, you look at those original movies and there's this video game Celeste, which is a game about this girl climbing a mountain. It's a fantastic game. And at the very end of the game, you find out that the girl is trans. And like, the creator of that game came out as trans a couple years after that game came out. And she was like, oh, I was using that game to work through this stuff and I didn't realize it. And I'm saying, like, the original Matrix trilogy is like the Celeste of movies.
100%. Like,
yeah, it's very much Lana and Lily working through some feelings and some ideas they have. And I know there are other people who disagree with me on this, but the timing just doesn't make sense for them to like be out to themselves in 1999. And like, if you read those movies as stories about self-acceptance, I think there's a really rich thing there. This movie is made by someone who's been out for at least 10 years, if not longer. She's, you know, you get to a point in your transition and in your life where you suddenly like are like, you know, I just want to kind of want to live my life. I don't want everything to be defined by my transness. And then a new Matrix movie comes out and every podcast in the world invites you on to talk about how it's a trans allegory. So,
but I think that I want to just talk for a very quick second about, or maybe not for a quick second, but I feel like the impetus of this film, for all intents and purposes, it should be said that the Wachowskis had put the Matrix to bed. They had no interest in doing more Matrix films. They were asked regularly by Warner Brothers to do one, and they just didn't have any real interest in doing it. What sparks it, and I'm going to read a very brief quote from Lana. She said, I couldn't have my mom and dad, yet suddenly I had Neo and Trinity, arguably the two most important characters of my life. It was immediately comforting to have these two characters alive again. And it's super simple. You can look at it and say, okay, these two people die, and okay, bring these two people back to life. And oh, doesn't that feel good? Yeah, it did. It's simple. And this is what art does. And this is what stories do. They comfort us and they're important. I bring this up because this was a coping mechanism with grief for all intents and purposes. The inception of this film is from that place. So this feels a lot more to me like a grace note or an epilogue to this franchise and less about starting a new trilogy, starting a new franchise or finding, do you sort of know what I'm getting at?
Yeah. And like, I think if this movie had been, if America had caught Matrix fever again, there's interesting places to go from this setup.
Sure.
I could easily see this being a thing where Lana has now said what she needs to with this franchise and she would pass it off to some other filmmaker or something.
Sure.
Or, you know, something, she would pass it off to known acclaimed filmmaker and creator of Emily in Charge on RFD TV, Emily Vanderwerf. But yeah, I, you know, there is something beautiful about this being the last movie. The only read of this movie that I push back on, I totally get why people don't like it. I totally get why people don't vibe with it. The only read I push back on is that it's cynical. I think it's deeply, deeply, deeply heartfelt.
Well, I want to reframe this. I watched less three, so these three, and not the first one, over the course of about 18 hours. I hadn't seen Reloaded in its entirety since the theater. I haven't seen a frame of Revolutions until since the theater. And obviously, I never saw Resurrection. So, so these three movies basically being first watches for me, right? Yeah. At least first critical watches. Like, sure. I did not like the sequels in the theater. I think they're fucking amazing after watching them again. Yeah. Tremendous. But I'm not in the headspace to analyze them and break them down the way I've broken down the original, which I've seen 50 times. Hmm. Having said that, I only can see Matrix Resurrections as a wildly romantic love story. That's the only thing that I connected with in terms of what I think this film is about and what I think this film is doing. Where I, you know, locked into this film, which I think is kind of true for the sequel as well. Like, I don't think the sequels are as rich or as rich a text as the original, but I think they are incredible action, world building. It's an incredible. But I think that's continued to this current one. But in terms of, you know, I mean, I loved all the meta shit. That really is canon for me. And I really do feel like I want them up in my gray matter. I think they're right about that. And I think there are elements of this film that get you there, but thankfully it wasn't all of the grist. Like, it really did feel about these two characters breaking free and finding each other. And that's all I wanted.
Well, so I watched it twice. So I went to see it in the theater in IMAX when it came out. And I'd be lying if I said that I was a little, I don't want to say confused, but a little discombobulated by the first like half hour of the film sitting in the theater. Just, you know, when you're in the modal and you're just like seeing different versions of things and you're, and the movie is grappling with like what is real and what is not for that first 30 minutes. That was a little bit confusing. Watching it a second time, it's actually a very clean, very simple story. Like it really isn't that complicated. I can understand.
It's almost too clean.
It might be. I agree. So it's interesting to watch it again and really just be hit with what Kenny's saying. The thing that I absolutely fucking love about this movie, and it might be the thing that I love most about this film, is the eradication of the notion of the one, and that it was never about the one. It was actually about the power of the two of them. Literally, their love powers the Matrix now. Yeah. like it's just amazing. That I absolutely adored.
And listen, I don't, again, I'm not going to push a trans reading on this film too hard, but it is about two trans lesbians love, just to like just driving all of reality, which is true. That is true. That is a thing that happens.
They do. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They power the world now. Yeah. I mean, but to your point, Kenny, I do think that so when the trailer for Resurrections came out, whenever it was, you know, 6 months ago or whatever, I rewatched all three of them again because I was like, I need them back in my life. And I wanted to reacquaint myself with it. And similar to Kenny, was really floored by this watch. I've watched the sequels a couple of times over the years, and Reloaded has always kind of hit me a little bit more. It's just quite frankly more fun than Resurrections is.
But they're both amazing.
Or sorry, they're both great than Revolutions, that is. And if you see them as one big movie, I actually think that's the best way to think of them. Mm-hmm. Because they kind of, they're the yin to each other's yangs, and they kind of, do you know what I mean? Like it really, to watch them back to back is kind of the best way to enjoy them. But it really kind of floored me how romantic these movies are. I would argue that the Wachowskis might be the most big-hearted, like filmmakers out there. Like, I understand that they never, you know, they haven't had a hit since The Matrix, a quote unquote hit, and that their films take time for people to really kind of grapple with. But once you do, like, they're just, they're big softies.
Yeah. They're just like, I mean, I think they share that in common with, weirdly, George Lucas.
Sure,
George Lucas is also like very much but George Lucas is like, comes at it from a very analytical perspective where he's like, what if love could power the universe? And like the Wachowskis are like, no, love absolutely powers the universe. Just think about that for a second. Yeah. But yeah, I think what has happened with the sequels is that the world has caught up to them a little bit. Like, they are movies that seem to have predicted our current moment in a weird way. And that's an accident. I don't think the Wachowskis are like psychic seers. They are actually. But but like, they just sort of accidentally predicted where we are in terms of like discourse, in terms of how we're thinking about facing the problems that face humanity. And I think this movie is similarly prescient, but also very much of the moment.
You're talking about Resurrection.
Yeah, Resurrection. Yeah.
It's interesting because Resurrection is going to be a really interesting movie to look back on 5-10 years from now, because now we're almost 20 years past the original sequels, and they are very prescient and they do really speak to this moment. My concern with Resurrections is it's also speaking directly to this moment.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Like very like Neil Patrick Harris has this monologue about how essentially, you know, you want to be angry, you want to be fighting, you want to be, you know, hating that power, like on some Monsters, Inc. shit. That powers the world more than love ever could, right?
The idea of your feelings are most important to you. Facts are less important than feelings.
But your bad feelings,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Your angry feelings. And that feels very true right now. No doubt about it.
Yeah,
but
I think the original movies were speaking to their moment in a similar way. Like my argument about the first Matrix has always been that it's very much a movie about the way people were feeling in the late 90s. It just had this deeper well beneath it that kept it relevant in a way that like American Beauty, a movie I do like, just hasn't had that resonance because it doesn't have that deeper well. It's just sort of like, what if you were unsatisfied with buying things? And like, yes, but also what? I don't know. And I feel like the same was true of the sequels. So I think there's always something that speaks to the now, and then there's something deeper. And maybe Resurrections doesn't have that deeper thing in it. It is kind of a weird remake of Monsters, Inc. now that you mention it. Like, I think that's a fascinating way to read this film, and we're going to do that for the next 2 hours. This is an allegory about monsters. And
can I just say, though, that I do feel
isn't it always a remake of Monsters, Inc.?
You made an interesting point about why The Matrix has stayed with us to some degree or another. And I do think that one of the major components is how fucking cool that movie is on top of everything else, right?
Yeah.
It's deeply rich. It's incredible. Yes, the original. The original movie holds up so unbelievably well aesthetically and technically that I would argue that, I mean, there are sequences in Reloaded that are phenomenal. I think the highway chase in particular is a tour de force. But there's also things that don't age so well. The Burly Brawl doesn't age as well. It looks kind of like a video game. There's some things that they kind of push themselves too far.
I thought I would hate it, but I don't hate it.
No, I mean, hate's a strong word. But I just mean in terms of The Matrix, because of its tactility and because of the fact that it was made at a certain time when films were made that way. And one of the backlashes you're seeing against Resurrections from the fans is that the action isn't as cool, quote unquote, or it doesn't have that sort of that spectacular cutting edge technical proficiency. I think it does, quite frankly, but I understand some people feeling like maybe it's not as overt as the other films. But the first Matrix film holds up so well that I just don't know if they could ever do that again, or if they're really interested in doing it.
Well, look, I want to just... So when I was watching the film, I was texting with you a lot of it, right?
You were. Reloaded, and
Reloaded and Revolution, but those two films, I was texting you and basically, you know, lamenting our society that we didn't that we didn't embrace this.
It was a lot of what was wrong with us in 2003.
A lot of what was wrong with us. And I've been thinking a lot about what was wrong with us. So in 2003, the other films, you know, obviously Reloaded was pretty high on the fucking box office list. But the other films that were high in the box office were Finding Nemo, Pirates of the Caribbean, Lord of the Rings, the first one, Bruce Almighty, X2, Elf, Chicago, Terminator Rise of the Machines, and Bad Boys 2. What was going on in 2000?
Real Murderer's Row.
Well, a Murderer's Row of
bits,
light ass, yeah. of light ass, unchallenging movies.
If you look at that Lord of the Rings film, which is the third and final, which won all the Oscars.
Sorry, you're right. It is the third.
Yeah. It's Return of the King.
And like that's a movie with a very clear cut good and evil. Like we are still in the wake of 9/11.
That's what I was going to get at, Ellie. Yes. Exactly. Yes. So in 99, we were pre 9/11, and you know there was this idea that I bring up on this podcast a lot, but it's the Rage Against the Machine video that had Al Gore and George Bush morph into one person. There was this idea that everybody in power was part of the same machine. And when you have a movie that says there is some kind of thing keeping us in place, it was everybody, right? It was everybody in power, and Matrix spoke to that moment. What happened in 9/11 really fucking fucked everybody up. We know it fucked everybody up, but it fucked us up in terms of like, drop all that idea about who the bad guys are for a moment. And like the bad guys are somewhere else and we're all the good guys. Like, if you're in America, if you're in the Western world, you're the good guys. And let's get on that idea for a second. So, yeah, this very clear binary between good and evil in most of the films I said, including a movie like X2, you know, which is just a fucking, you know, terrorism fighting movie, big, strong American guy against foreign evil people.
And also, like, you know, racism to some degree. It's like all an allegory for like them and us and all that sort of stuff.
Of course, which, by the way, most of these films are. That I think is why these films, which like on rewatch are like crowd pleasers, world building, they're rich, they're fun, they're cool. I think that's why they didn't connect at the time, because they are difficult, right?
I actually want to push back on this a little bit, because I had gotten to a point where I was like, well, people have realized the Matrix sequels are at least interesting. You know, they maybe haven't gotten to the point where they like them, but they've at least been like, there was more going on there. We were wrong to judge them harshly. And then I've had enough conversations where I'm like, no, people still hate these fucking movies.
Yes, they really
totally. People haven't watched them.
They would go and they'd revisit them because they knew the new movie was coming. And they would be like, I still hate. And it's because it deconstructs the Chosen One thing. I really think that's what it is. These movies are like, and in 2003, that was really radical, especially in the wake of 9/11, especially at a time when I think the first one came out like 6 weeks after the invasion of Iraq. Like it's also
about 2 months after, a month after Columbine. I mean, you know.
Oh, the first sequel, sorry. Reloaded comes out about 6 weeks after the invasion of Iraq.
Yeah.
Like, we're in this space where we're like, we're questioning, but we don't want to question, etc. And these two movies, the end of The Matrix is so satisfying in terms of Neo achieving his potential. Mm-hmm. And we want to believe that means that he's the best ever. And then the two sequels are like, there is no one person. It has to be everybody. And that's a very challenging thing, because you're like, if we have to fix the world together, I kind of hate everybody. I don't know if I want to do that.
Well, here's another thing about the matrices that I think plays on that. I'm putting myself back in 99 and what Phil just said about them being cool movies. I think the mock obsession with bullet time in Resurrections. The new one in Resurrections is interesting, but it's a little misplaced. I don't think that is what got people so excited. I really think it is the idea, the Terminator-esque idea of us all being plugged into something and living in a simulation that really got people going, right? And I just refuse to believe that anybody who really engaged in this movie came back and said, I want to see more bullet time. Like, that's just not what gets people going. It's, I want to see what's going to happen with this simulation world. I want to see it dismantled, and I want to see or where it goes or whatever. And I think and I said this to Phil, I think what's really interesting about the sequels is they're not they don't take place within the simulation. They don't take place within the Matrix. Our characters and, you know, by extension, the audience are unplugged from the Matrix throughout that movie. You are playing, you are set in and you were set around the Matrix and occasionally go into it. And I think that was off-putting for people because outside of the part with the architect, which I think turned people off in Rushworth, I think is pretty amazing, didn't answer those questions of what is the Matrix? How does it serve the larger purpose and how are humans going to overcome this? And I think just for me at the time, I'm still having trouble with it, but not in like a I hate it way. And like, I'm still parsing it. The resolution being essentially work with the machines was a tough one to swallow.
Yeah. But I mean, like, you have to think about it from the perspective of if this really happened, if we were all in a computer simulation and we suddenly woke up to it and like we were just jerked out of it and thrown into a post-apocalyptic reality, that would suck. That would not be fun. Like there is something about like the only way to reform the system is to partially become the system, but also overthrow the system. Like revolutions only work if they like find a way to co-opt what they're overthrowing and make it better. And like, you know, the story of revolution is the people who overthrow something often have really great intentions and often make it, you know, however far, but then it inevitably gets corrupted because people are complicated and stupid. And like that,
which also, you know, speaks so much to Resurrections, right? I mean, mm-hmm. so much of that initial conversation between Tom and Jonathan Groff is about just that thing, right? It's, I mean, you really do feel in this film Lana grappling with what does it mean for me as an artist to make another one of these movies? Like, is there a symbiotic relationship I can have with a studio? What the art form that I have chosen to work in is unbelievably expensive and requires me to find some sort of commonality with Warner Brothers, specifically with this film. But and so you're feeling that post-revolution idea. It's I mean, it's,
you know what, Phil? This is interesting because this is something you and I talk about all the time. And we fight about all the time. But what's interesting about our industry,
yeah,
is it's the only industry I can think of where someone who has no management skills and no aspirations to be management, if they rise up high enough,
yes,
become management. And sometimes become the CEOs of these major companies, like Lucasfilm, for instance. And ultimately, I would argue, become the bad guys. Almost.
This is very much Kenny's argument.
This is the hill I die on, and I hope no one really listens to it, except everyone's going to listen to this episode.
Because I do want to butt in and say this also happens in journalism. Like, my career has been materially impacted by not, you know, pushing further into management. But like, I was management for a long time because I just was like good at writing, and they were like, well, you're probably also good at managing people. And
right.
I was like, what?
Well, I mean, whether you're good at it or not, at least you acknowledge your management, right? Like, that's the thing that like happens in this industry. What's interesting, if you read it, all right, so if Trinity and Neo are essentially the Wachowskis or just Lana, I mean, it's hard to say exactly what they are, but that's who they are. Right.
Or in they're this, her parents.
Or they're her parents. But yeah. I mean, I feel like let's read it as it being her, because like I think Neo very clearly is like the her in the, at least in the first third of this movie. Right. And then I think, you know, there's a reason that these two actors look almost identical. So I think there's something going on there. If the resolution of this movie is Neo and Trinity have now taken over the Matrix. They are, so the system is still in place and there is still a, you know, there's still utility for this system, but now they're the benevolent leaders of it. And we're supposed to walk away and be happy with that. Which is, by the way, also kind of what happened in the end of Revolutions. It makes me wonder if the next episode of this movie, should there be one, Trinity and Neo are the bad guys.
I do think there's a very meet the new boss, same as the old boss aspect to this. One thing I've been interested in following in the fandom is sort of their question of, is this like just a matrix? Are there now many matrices and some of them are better than others? And this is just the one that Neo and Trinity happen to be stuck in, etc. It's like, it's clear that the world has moved on. Time has moved on. Things are different. Humans and machines are working together in some ways. In some ways, they're not. It's a very like, there. So yeah, I think there is this question of, are they, by taking over, the second you take over, you become the system people have to fight against. And like, right. I think Lana Wachowski is very interested in that question, especially across the second decade of her career. Cloud Atlas, Jupiter Ascending, Sense8 are all to some degree wrestling with this question of like, what does it mean to have power? Because some people have to have power, but how do you share that equitably, et cetera, et cetera? Also, what if two trans lesbians in love were powering all of humanity?
Because they do, obviously.
Yes.
Yes. I mean, I think that, you know, my counter to Kenny when we discuss this is I don't think it's binary. Specifically in a creative environment. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's where things get ambiguous, you know what I mean? And intangible to some degree or another. I think that's what Lana grapples with specifically in this film, it feels like, in terms of how do I make another one of these things, scratch the itches that I'm dealing with, and also make something that conceivably is, you know, lucrative, I guess. I mean, part of it to me, what's interesting, Kenny, I think to some degree, as you were texting me, I was thinking about this, that like, yes, Warner Brothers has wanted to make another Matrix movie. And I, on some level, I understand that. On another level, I think to myself, people hated the sequels. So on some level, you've got to say what you really want is more of the first Matrix. And they're never going to give you that. So on listen, pandemic and box office, all these sort of things, would this film have been more successful in a different time? Is it still successful with its HBO Max release? Who the fuck knows? All of those are intangibles. But I think this film was always going to piss people off.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did think it was interesting.
Yeah.
The way now they broke down the Matrix and fandom and all that stuff pretty incisively. But one thing they never said was the first was good and the second two were not good.
Yeah.
They didn't have an asshole character that was never spoken. The asshole said I didn't even like the first. But but no one said over and over again it was the original trilogy. Yeah. They were strewn through there were these flashbacks or however you want to call it that Neo was experiencing that were strewn, you know, throughout the three movies. It's very clear to me that Lana at least views this as one piece of art, take it or fucking
which I respect the hell out of, and I'm putting my like Warner Brothers executive hat on and saying, so you want a Matrix sequel and you want it from the Wachowskis, you're begging them to give you this because you believe rightly that the fan base and they're you need to have the original voices, the original people behind it, and that's completely justified. That being said, you also have to ask yourself, diminishing returns on a box office level between Reloaded and Revolutions to a significant degree, almost $200 million drop off between the two films. A series that has been reappraised to some degree, but a lot of people still, as you mentioned, really don't like them. I guess my question is, if you sat down with any number of Warner Brothers executives off the record and asked them, if you could have made that Michael B. Jordan Morpheus prequel that Zach Penn, you know, has talked about trying to do and, you know, give the reboot and the blah, 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 would it have made more money? Would it have, you know, been the movie that your less diehard fans wanted? I mean, the answer to that obviously is probably yes.
Yes, probably. But it also, like, I don't know. I watched the original Matrix. I watched the original trilogy. There's all these little hints of things. There's all these little hints of world building. like, I remember famously Harry Knowles didn't like the now disgraced film journalist. Ain't I don't know what to call
cool
him.
News he was guy.
Yeah. He wrote Ain't It Cool News. Film he famously jerk. Said in Matrix Reloaded, there's this little thing about like how vampires and werewolves are like second generation Matrix, whatever. And he was like, I want more of that. I'm like, no, you don't. Like, it's an interesting idea that the second you follow it is like, well, that's just a one level idea. But I think that we're in a culture, and I think this movie sort of grapples with that, where what people want is those one thing ideas that are like, oh, what if we saw Morpheus as a, what if we saw Morpheus before he was Morpheus? And like, yeah, maybe that would be fun, but like, there's nowhere to go with that story. It's just like a story you already know, but we kind of want stories we already know right now. Like, that is comforting, and I don't want to take that comfort away from people. I think Spider-Man No Way Home, which we're all kind of grappling with right now because it's this humongous hit, is an interesting example of giving people what they want. But I haven't thought about that movie nearly as much as I've thought about Matrix Resurrections, which frustrated me more but also pleased me more than a movie that just kind of gave me what I knew I wanted.
I loved both of these movies, and I loved Spider-Man 2. And I give it a lot of credit for, you know, a filmed version of someone's, you know, fan fiction dream, and also being an entertaining movie, which seems nearly impossible. Phil and I know, and Emily, I'm sure you mess around with this too, is 85% of the generals I go on that are associated with the studio, they're like, we're getting pitched IP all the time. Yeah. And, you know, and what they really want is for you to find a side character and figure out a way to give them their whole show. And the way to do it 95% of the time is through a fucking prequel. And I think prequels are almost always the worst. And even the ones I think are like conceptually not the worst. Like, I think Rogue One is conceptually a really great idea that I thought was really boring in execution. So I think that it just, when you're talking about Morpheus, the Michael B. Jordan idea and the idea of a prequel with Morpheus, the only prequel I'd want to see with Morpheus is something that takes place out. I mean, the only one I'd want to see is the Terminator 3 Rise of the Machines version. That's the only thing about this world that I'm interested in at this point.
Well, because that's the stuff that hasn't been unpacked in. You know what I mean? Like, there's a world building component to that that we haven't seen. Whereas, like, a Morpheus coming into his own, I feel like I know what that story is.
There's no coming into his own because it's all within a matrix that we know he doesn't alter. Yep. So, or probably.
I think the way to do what Warner Brothers probably most wants is just make some more Animatrix films where you dig into, like, you get little shorts that are like digging into these world building elements. Like, I don't know if those can power a movie, but
just to be clear, I'm not a proponent of doing a prequel with Michael B. Jordan.
I think
that it's what's interesting about all of this too, and all of this is unintentional and by mistake, but like the Matrix Resurrections also feeding into this HBO Max component as well of how we watch things, how Warner Brothers makes money off of movies and is also part of this too. That's all part of the machine, right? It's so to some degree or another, I watched this film thinking, if I was a Warner Brothers executive, why would I want this movie? Is ultimately really what it comes down to. And I think that the bigger reason is you're rebooting it to some degree. Can you now make a television show? Can you now make, you know, animatrixes? Can you do things off of it by, you know, bringing it back to the consciousness?
Like, serious question. Mm-hmm. Do you think Lana got notes on this movie?
No.
Yeah, I don't either. I think they basically said, come back and do what you want.
Yeah, 100%.
I would not be surprised if, like, she got some, like, people said, hey, here's some thoughts we have. And she was like, okay.
Thanks. Noted.
Yeah.
I mean, I do wonder if there's... I agree that I don't think they got any notes, but I also wonder as well that Warner Brothers was so desperate to get them to do one. So on some level, it's like, whatever you want, you can do whatever you want. But then I also feel like Jupiter Ascending was a big flop, a very expensive flop that, you know, that was theoretically the beginning of another universe or another franchise. There were a lot of, you know, possibilities wrapped up in that movie. You have to wonder whether or not Warner Brothers is like, the only thing that we're willing to let the Wachowskis go off the chain for again is a Matrix movie.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I'm fascinated by how the Wachowski sincerity seems to like,
yes,
constantly like bite them in the moment. In the moment, people don't want sincerity. And then 10 years later, they're like, why can't we just have nice, sincere things? And then they, you know, I don't like to turn the Marvel movies into the villain, because I think there's some very good ones and there's some very bad ones, but all of them have this kind of arch tone that like we want in the moment. And then, you know, 5 years from now, which of those do I still think about? You know, like sincerity, like play is, has a great long tail, but in the moment, rarely. Yeah. So
when I also feel like, if you remember,
do you still think about? Just interested.
I think about the first Avengers. I think that's a really well-constructed movie. I do think about Black Panther. I think about how that captured a moment. I think about Guardians 2 all the time. I think that is an interesting movie, and that's maybe the most sincere Marvel movie. And I think about Endgame just because the experience of watching that movie in a crowded theater was like nothing else. Yeah. I have big problems with that movie, but like when you watch that with a room full of people, it was just like one of the great experiences. And then it had the good fortune of coming out 6 months before a pandemic or whatever it was, where like suddenly we couldn't have that experience. I would just go watch YouTubes of people reacting to that movie and just being like, this is what life used to be like.
That movie is a staggering, whether, you know, issues with it aside, landing that plane is insane.
Yeah.
I just, in terms of the Marvel movies, speaking of what you're talking about, I basically have a headcanon where Tony Stark and Pepper Potts are like the mom and dad of this universe, because that's the relationship that always stuck with me, and the relationship I cared about at the end of Endgame, and the relationship that carried me through those three movies and other movies too. And I think it's interesting that Guardians has a, you know, real tried and true love story. And I think, you know, for me, my genuine favorite one is Homecoming, and that's built on, you know, real genuine emotions and real pathos and a lot of stuff. So yeah, I completely agree with you when it comes to the relative value of sincerity in the moment versus down the road.
I also think that they are, you know, I remember sitting in the theater for Speed Racer, and I remember thinking it was exhausting. At the time, I remember just feeling that the visuals of that movie were just relentless. Now I watch that film and see that it was about, you know, 10 years ahead of the game in terms of just being so all enveloping. Like just they understood where, and they continue to understand where things are going. But I remember, I mean, as I'm sure we all do, people rejected Speed Racer in a way that was visceral. Mm-hmm. People really, really didn't like that movie. You know, Cloud Atlas is a movie that also pushed people's buttons in ways that people didn't really know how to deal with. Both of those have had reclamations. Both of those movies now people think are brilliant. I just think they're ahead of the game.
I loved Cloud Atlas at the time. I do think Cloud Atlas engages with the Wachowskis' giant blind spot around race in ways that are complicated and hard to watch and problematic. Correct. But I think it's their best movie all the same.
That criticism kind of kills me because it's baked into that movie. It's explicitly about, you know, universal themes, and to me that's a weird kind of egg you had to break to make this omelet.
But yeah, it's just one of those things where they do it to just enough of a degree that it bugs you.
Yeah,
if they were doing it way more, it would be way more racist, but you'd be like, okay, I guess we have to do this. And if they did it not at all, you'd be like, I'm glad they avoided doing that. But like, it's, they do it just enough for you to be like, this is kind of racist. And like that, that bugs you, you know, because it is racist.
But I mean, even the racist components aside, people bumped on just the general construction of it, right? Like, what am I supposed to care about? Who am I supposed to care about? Yep. What does all of this mean?
All of these people are six people. And like that's...
Yes.
I mean, and that, that same thing happened with Sensei, like, which is really...
Good for this, them. Like,
yeah.
It's just, it's so cool. I mean, like, whether these are, you know, like... Like whether these are brilliant swings that connected or whether they're these giant massive misfires. And I think everybody feels that way about all these films with the exception of the first Matrix. There are people who think they're brilliant, people who think they are misfires. But God, are we lucky that they have had a basically $1 billion to play with over the last 25 years to try their wild shit out. And that's really cool. Like, I couldn't think of any better people to spend a bill.
One of the things I think about with the Wachowskis is there was this period in like Steven Spielberg's life where he was kind of on the outs. And then he says, I'm going to adapt this book, Jurassic Park. I'm going to make this a movie. And it becomes a huge global phenomenon. Like if the Wachowskis, when they were at the point after Cloud Atlas, which is, of course, their one adaptation. Well, Speed Racer is also an adaptation. But, like, they make these two adaptations that are poorly received. But if they had just been like, we have a really, like, potboiler novel. Mm-hmm. We're just going to adapt straight up. They would have resurrected their career because they're 100%. That good of filmmakers. But instead, they do Jupiter Ascending. And, like, my big pitch is always Lana Wachowski should make the Hadestown movie because I love that musical and it's an anti-capitalist thing about, like, the end of the world. And I'm like, Lana Wachowski, give her $30 million and, like, cast Zendaya as Eurydice. And you thought that movie writes its own checks. No, nobody likes musicals anymore either. We don't like anything. We just like Spider-Man.
I am crazy. I mean, I don't think it's really a contrarian take.
Yeah.
But, like... and I know you're not, you guys wouldn't disagree with this, but basically like,
I already do.
They got their start. Their first film was Bound, which is a, you know, brilliant,
great and fucking movie.
Very well, very critically well received film that basically takes place in two apartments, and basically has three characters. And part of you says, well, why don't they, or Lana, if Lily's not making films anymore, why don't they go and make a film like that? The bigger part of me says, if they're giving you $200 million, it's your fucking responsibility to spend that money.
I do think that like Lily is doing that. Lily's making this weird little Showtime show. She directs.
What show is it? I really don't know.
Work in progress.
Yeah. It's a very good show. She directs 2-3 episodes a year and like she writes a bunch of them. She's just off doing the thing where like she wasn't involved in the pilot, but the pilot was made for like $50,000 and she came on board then as a producer to get it, to keep making it. And now she's gotten more involved. It's very strange, very queer. Like, I think Lily is very interested in trying to work in that side of the space. Like, people forget that one of the scripts they broke through with was this, like, this tiny budgeted cannibalism thing where they were like, we could do this, you know, George Romero style for like $500,000, or we could do it for $5 million, but you kind of can't do it beyond that. And, like, I do think there is sort of that interest within at least Lily and playing within that space. And I'm interested to see if she like ends up doing something with like a Blumhouse or something like that.
But didn't they have a military thing at some point? There was some like a military, right? Something about like breaking, gender roles within the military, if I'm not mistaken.
They like made some of it and then like they stopped making it.
It's really, I mean, it should be said just in terms of resurrections,
obviously Lily was not involved, although she did, she was quoted in saying, you know, she gave her blessing to come up with a story even better than the original. She also elaborated in saying she needed time away from the industry to reconnect with herself as an artist, and that going back to school and painting and stuff like that. And that she was, you know, in addition to being obviously emotionally affected by the passing of her parents. So it does feel like, I mean, Lily and Lana have shuttered their company. They had a company, a production company. And when that shut down and then Lily went off to do this show, everyone sort of was like, well, I guess we're done. I guess we're not getting any more Wachowski movies. I don't think that that's necessarily the case. I could see them coming back together again and doing something in the future.
Certainly sounds like they don't hate each other.
Certainly.
Well, one isn't retired a la Ethan Coen.
But. Right. There does seem to be sort of this, and so I was reading about the production halt because of COVID, which I think is an interesting little, this speaks to what we're talking about, which is, so March 16, 2020, the production shut down because of COVID. And Wachowski, Lana, contemplated the possibility of never finishing the film and letting it, quote unquote, go down as an incomplete legendary film not meant to be seen by anyone. It then took many months.
That rules.
Can you imagine?
And then it took many months of the cast pestering her to finish the film until she eventually relented and agreed. And then on August 16th, they resumed production in Berlin. It is interesting that she was willing to be like, fuck it, I'm done. Like, whatever, no one's ever going to see this thing. It speaks to this idea that, like, I think they like doing films, but they're fine not doing it. That if it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen.
I think the twin reactions they seem to have had to the deaths of their parents are like the most common artistic reactions to dealing with grief. Like Lana's like, I'm going to throw myself into making this big statement totally. In a world that I'm already familiar with, you know, like, and then Lily's like, I'm going to go up and do make something really tiny and personal and like not spend a lot of money. And like, I think it's interesting they had those divergent reactions. I do kind of hope and think they will come back together, but
I do too.
I think it will be like a Jurassic Park thing where they have to like adapt a book and like they're going to be watched really closely by the studio. But like, they love comics, they love anime. Those are things that people are constantly wanting. Like the Wachowski Neon Genesis Evangelion movie. I love that series. I don't think it should ever be an American movie, but if they made it, I'd be like, I'll see, Wachowskis. Let's see what you do with this.
Tell me you wouldn't watch Gideon the Ninth directed by the Wachowskis. I mean,
that would be so good.
Speaking of a book that I'm reading right now that I know you love.
Phil, the sequel to that, Harrow the Ninth, Harrow the Ninth is the Matrix Reloaded of sci-fi books. It is, people have kind of come around on it. I loved it at the time. That is the kind of thing where I don't know how you adapt it because of what it does with POV, but like, the Wachowskis are the only ones who should, therefore they should make the Gideon the Ninth movie, which I think is, no, the problem is they'll turn Gideon the Ninth into a friggin' TV show. And like, there's not enough there for a TV show. You know, maybe a, like three,
I think we agree that like, I think they come back together. I think they do something together. The question ultimately is, you know, is it Warner Brothers that bankrolls them, right? Like, or is it a Netflix, or is it some sort of a you know, a different company that decides to get behind them? But someone would. I mean, I don't think there's a question.
Is Warner Brothers the only studio that's building those kinds of relationships with filmmakers now? Like,
well, Disney, Chris Nolan would say otherwise.
I mean, yeah, Chris Nolan went over to Universal, but like he was, you know, he was their guy. Eastwood's their guy. The Wachowskis, of course, they've bankrolled
Todd
many
Phillips.
Times. Disney kind of is doing this with Chloe Zhao, but like that's ish. It. You know, and like they are not like, you know, they're not like just burning down the door to do Chloe Zhao's, I don't know, friggin' Gideon the Ninth adaptation.
I do, you know, in terms of Resurrections, I wanted to kind of dig into the fandom for a second, because I do think that, you know, Kenny, you were talking about, you know, in rewatching the sequels, seeing how the sequels were embraced by certain people, obviously the majority, not so much. Mm-hmm. And then seeing how this film is embraced is really interesting to me. There, I mean, Twitter is obviously a dumpster answer and really should be a barometer of much. But watching this film's dissemination amongst people that I expected to really love it and not like it was surprising to me. People that I very much respect, very smart, you know, incisive individuals. What do you think that's about? Do you think that there's just that the film is just too alienating?
I think nothing to say.
Go ahead.
Either of you. I mean,
I think this movie is.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to Amazon.com/comedy ad free. That's Amazon.com/comedy ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I think this movie sounds like, sorry, I got a random email that threw me. I think that this movie, leave it in, leave that in. It's important that everyone know it. I just got an email.
Always wrong.
Emily got an email, guys.
Yeah.
Emily got an email. I think that this movie engages with fandom in a similar way to The Last Jedi. And I think that we are living in an era when people are so used to being catered to. And like, that's not unusual. That has always been the case. You look back at like the Thin Man movies, and they are trying to give the audience what it wants from a Thin Man movie. And like, I'm not saying this is a bad thing. I'm not saying fan service is bad. I'm saying now it's all we're used to. So when we get something that pushes buttons, it really freaks people out. And I think the reaction to this movie has been similar to the reaction to The Last Jedi. The Last Jedi was just so huge that like everything got magnified. But like the backlash to this movie, well, it's disappointing to me as someone who loves this movie and loves this franchise. Is like, I don't know, I get it all the same.
Kenny, you watched the sequels back to back with this film, and then you saw the way that it was, you know, the reaction to it.
Well, I saw the reaction first, right?
Okay, so like, right.
I'm behind on everything, and I watched. I actually went to the theater yesterday to watch this with my son.
That's awesome.
I saw the reaction first, and I'll be honest. You know, like based on those who liked it and those who didn't, I thought the right side was to like this. My sense was the right side was to like this movie. I don't know. I think people would push back. I think those who didn't like it, because to your point, Phil, it's not the idiots who like Don't Look Up who are liking this movie. It's a lot of people that we like and respect who aren't liking this movie. Yes. Right. So I think that they would push back at the idea that it's not that I'm saying you're saying this, but the idea that it's different or uncomfortable or you know, it's too challenging. I think what I've seen from the few who don't like it is, you know, things like it just doesn't work for me and it doesn't feel right to me. And I would say, you know, look, I think it's the fourth best of the four, frankly.
Interesting.
And part of that is, I think it's a bit of a step back in terms of the mythology. I think returning to the Matrix is a fan service that is fan service. That makes me a little uncomfortable.
I think I think that the show. I think that this, we were talking about this earlier. I think one of the problems that this movie has to exist within, which I think it navigates well, is that we are all just so aware we live in the Matrix now. Like Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, etc. are versions of the Matrix that we are all aware of, and we're aware of how they like pervert our emotions. And yet we're still like, I gotta see what's going on Twitter. You know, like we're so addicted to them. And I think that that is part of kind of what they're dealing with. To your point, I think one of the worst things that's happened to the people who don't like this movie, who I think many of them have great points and many of them have are valid readings of the film, is that the same thing that happened with Last Jedi, where there's this loud, angry group of yahoos who are like mad at this movie for being quote unquote woke. And you know, that has perverted the conversation in a way that doesn't allow us to like actually talk about criticisms people have of this movie, which I think you can make criticisms. I prefer it to Revolutions, but you know, only slightly. I think it has interesting flaws. Like it's in my top 10 of whatever, but like what year did we just go through? 2021?
2021. Yeah. Yeah.
It's in my top 10 of the never-ending 2018. Go ahead.
I was just gonna say that, you know, I similar to you, I think I like it a little bit more than Revolutions, but again, it's pretty minute. My book keeps going back to this place of it being, and I don't mean to diminish it. This is gonna sound diminishing, but it's not. That it feels like an epilogue or a grace note or sort of this nice appendage to the previous three films, that it's a nice kind of little wrap up, where we dip in. It feels intimate. It feels slighter than the previous films. It's not as dense in its own way. It's also just, it kind of taps into one of my favorite moments when Niobe is talking about the quiet that they have when they're not plugged into the movie feels a little quieter than the other films in its own way. Mm-hmm. Obviously aesthetically different director photography. We don't see the green of the previous Matrix films. It's a lot more sunshine and golden and just kind of this idea of what a new Matrix looks like. All these things to me, I was reading online about, you know, people that are now like, what's the next one going to be? And is this a trilogy? And it's like, you missed the point entirely if you're asking for more of them.
I think I would watch a new movie.
I think
if they're going to do something new, if the Wachowskis want to make Matrix movies, I will continue seeing them. I would not mind seeing Lana Wachowski be like, this is my protege and they're going to make a Matrix movie.
Right.
You know, in the way that Spielberg should have done with Indiana Jones long, long, long ago.
Sure. Or Jurassic Park.
Sort of. Well, he did with Jurassic Park. but twice. That's the thing about these people. They're not the best at choosing proteges.
Johnston is an American hero.
I know how people dare love Joe Johnston.
How dare.
I can't wait till Blank Check does their Joe Johnston series with you.
They're Joey J. He made October Sky. I want to ask something.
Yes.
What about this film? All right, I understand conceptually why the jerks came for Last Jedi on the grounds that it was woke, because it had women in positions of power. Yeah. But that's always been true for the Matrix, always. You know, that's a hallmark of this film.
Lest we forget, though, the first Matrix spawned the red pill. Like, there are people who read these movies as right-wing revanchist texts, basically.
I'm happy to talk about that in a sec. but what about this film is particularly woke in a way that someone can point to? And I have my theory, and I'm going to say it before one of you do. Okay. Nothing about it is woke. And it is simply woke because it is a high profile film made by a trans filmmaker.
Correct.
But I don't
starring
think there's
some gay people.
Yes. Yeah. But I don't think there's anything about this that they can point to in with I don't think so. All right, so that's all I got.
I mean, do you think it's woke, Emily?
I want to just do a quick little sidebar on how Bugs and Lexi are in love. And the end of this movie is about them being in love. And like, there's so much lesbian yearning in this film.
Can we talk about just Bugs in general? Bugs?
Yeah. Nuts,
but anyway, I mean,
we'll come back to Bugs.
Bugs is my big problem with the movie.
What?
What? Bugs is like great. Bugs?
So here's the irony of this whole thing. No, Bugs is fantastic. It's not a Bugs issue.
Okay.
I texted Phil during Revolutions, and I want to read the text.
Wow, from the theater. You're teaching your son wonderful behavior. No,
this was Revolutions.
Never would do that during Resurrections. Wow. What am I, an animal? All right. I texted...
You definitely text during movies, though, by the way.
No, I don't. I mean, during kids' movies, of course.
I remember you watched being like, the best part is sitting in the back row. So
I always sit in the back row when we watch kids' movies so I can look at my phone and I don't have to watch, you know. Well, I love... I mean, don't get me wrong. I love
the actual No, I get it.
Phil, we text a lot, dude.
You text a lot, man. We text
all fucking day long.
I don't remember which text you're referring to.
It's not when I told you that they should make a Porkins series.
He did say they should make a Porkins Star Wars television show.
What do you think of that idea, Emily? In the
I think I'm immediately greenlighting it. we're going to air it on RFD TV right after Emily in Charge.
Do you run RFD TV as well? Is that
I wish I did. RFD TV is one of my favorite weird things because it actually exists and it's mostly just like farm auctions. And I'm like, they should get into original scripted programming.
I mean, I'll pitch you my idea for a reality show after this. Oh my God. Here's what I texted Phil.
What did you
say? Middle of this film. You know what I really all caps love about The Matrix? No one has a fucking British accent to signify status, dignity, or intelligence. Because I hate that as a lazy fucking signifier of status, dignity, or intelligence. And it's strewn throughout every other sci-fi and fantasy series as if Westeros is England, as if like fucking Middle Earth is England, as if the fucking empire is run by fucking English people. It's lunacy to me. And having Bugs with her British accent in this film tore me apart. It tore me apart. That's it.
They just love Jessica, understandably. And she
was
rad.
Great. She was great. And it was cool. And I got over it. But I thought it was funny that I texted that to you and you heart emojied it. And then you didn't tell me that it was going to be blown to bits.
I wasn't going to say that to you. I was going to be like, oh, FYI, Bugs has a fucking British accent.
Yeah.
I'd forgotten she had a British accent until
kind of pseudo-British, quite frankly. It's not like, it's I think it's more like...
British. She calls people mate. She jumps on the lorry. I mean, it's over the top.
She does neither of these things. she does say, what's up, Doc, though. Which is
she does have
the famous, was good.
She does have her famous catchphrase, which she says seven times, biscuits, Gavna.
she does. Many times.
I when Phil said Jessica, I got so excited that Phil somehow knows Jessica Henwick and he was gonna add her to the call and I was gonna say hi.
We only do that with Lou Diamond Phillips.
Yeah,
we only have Lou Diamond Phillips on speed dial. I'll say this: I do think, I do think that Bugs is the best new character. As much as I like the new team, and I do like Lexi and the various other people, Bugs is just. I'd watch a Bugs show. I'd watch a Bugs franchise. I mean, Bugs is great. Jessica Henwick's obviously great. And I don't know. I mean, her character definitely, her and Lexi definitely are in love, right? I mean, I didn't have any question about that.
Yeah. They're in love. Yeah. That is one of the things where the third act of this movie does feel like it had about 20 minutes chopped out of it. And that is kind of my big problem with it. But I feel like if there was a note on this movie, it was Warner Brothers saying, you cannot make these characters canonically in love. Like they are, you can look at the two of them and the way that Bugs throws herself into danger for Lexi and like the way they're kind of holding each other at the end. And you're like, yeah, they're lesbians, but they never actually say it. And that is as a queer woman who writes stuff that sometimes people look at and say, this is interesting. We can't make this because it's about queer people. That really bugs me that you can't just say Bugs and Lexi are in love. It's not like the Princess Elsa thing, you know, where whatever.
Or Luca.
I don't know. Yeah.
Although Luca is
super gay. I mean,
they're canonically in love. Come on.
I'll say this. I do think that this film, which is the longest Matrix movie, which I was surprised to know. The other sequels feel much longer. And I think it's because they're denser. I think it's because they're, quite frankly, trying to do more. And again, that's not a slight on this film, but I just think that those two movies are really going for broke. This movie moves quite cleanly, quite quickly. It doesn't feel long. The only time, and I think you were sort of tapping into this, Emily, the third act of the film does feel a little rushed, and it does feel a little bit like we got to get them to the top of this building. It's surprisingly small. Like, it's a coffee shop and a chase and a roof. Like, it's not, you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't have that much going on, but it does feel a little bit too streamlined for its own good.
We somehow got here from talking about whether the movie is woke. And I think what it is not, I would not say it's a woke movie any more than the other Matrices,
right,
any more than any blockbuster. I think it is not a subtle movie. And if you were someone who looked at that first movie and read it as a crypto-fascist text, this movie is doing everything it can to tell you, no, that was wrong. Machines and humans work together now. There are no binaries. You know what? The red and the blue pill is a false choice. And here, our brand new, cool, lesbian cyberpunk character has blue hair and is presented as an alternate option. And like, the color scheme is going to feature red and blue in like really alternating, interesting ways. And also, there's a big, big friendly robot named Sebebe, and he's your new best friend. It is saying to you, if you read this movie in a right wing fashion, it is trying hard as hell to not let you read this new movie. And I'm sure people will, because people are allowed to have their own interpretations of things. But like, it is a movie that's trying to guard against that.
Well, you tapped into something in your article that I think is one of the shitty readings of this film, if people want to find shitty readings. And one of them is that this movie is somehow, negative about therapy. Yeah.
And that's
the only, not the only, I'm sure that there'll be any number of shitty readings of this by the right. But that's the one that I feel could perhaps be misinterpreted.
Yeah, and I think that there is a lot of suicidal imagery in it that I think people have taken issue with in ways that I think are interesting. I don't agree with, but I see where they're coming from. Right. As someone who's struggled with ideation in the past, go ahead.
That was something my son took away from it. Actually, a 9-year-old, but he did mention that all these people were jumping out of buildings, killing themselves at the end of this. And look, he didn't have school yesterday because this is ridiculous. You know, no one can get testing done in time. So I'm hanging with him. I didn't have much to do with him. I said, I'm going to see The Matrix. He hasn't seen any of the previous three. So I did my best to like run him through it before.
Oh boy.
But, you know, I don't think that he quite understood the eyes turn green-ish and they're no longer jumping making their own decisions.
Yeah.
Yeah, that out of context, basically my son saw it out of context. It was probably a little shocking.
I do think, I do wonder if it still is obeying the you die in the Matrix, you die in real life thing, because it feels like swarm mode, in essence, turns a person into an agent. And in the original, if you become an agent, then you are eventually returned to your life.
Correct.
They also shatter
into code in a way that makes me think that it's not a death in the real world.
I think they're trying to suggest it's not actually suicide, but also, I mean, it's obviously not suicide. Their impulses are overridden by a larger system. It's a metaphor about friggin' Twitter, but
it doesn't really matter. Yeah. They're NPCs anyway. Like, it doesn't really matter.
Every human life matters. Go ahead, Phil.
Yeah. Corporations are people. I think that the other thing too that should be said about specifically about Neo and then in turn Trinity at the end jumping off the building is a big part of the first one, as we all remember. One of the big tests that Neo has to take is jumping off the building. More than anything, jumping from building to building as opposed to jumping off a building. But all that being said, the idea of the leap, you know, the leaps that we have to take. That's more of what they're talking about, obviously, on the Neo and Trinity side of things. But I do understand how people can unfortunately misinterpret that if they choose to. But.
Yeah. I think
I
don't know. My read of the movie is so informed by the fact that I've been in trauma therapy the past year for just some dumb shit that happened to me when I was a kid. I mean, it destroyed my life. But also I think this movie, I found this movie intensely moving on that angle, but like no one person who's been through this, who's experienced suicidal ideation, who's been to therapy that hasn't worked for them, who's been to trauma therapy that hasn't worked for them, is going to take the same thing away from this movie. I think somebody involved in the movie at some point has been through trauma therapy, sure, and was like, we want to talk about this. I don't know what to take away from it.
Lana has talked about how she had suicidal thoughts, mm-hmm, and that she had a moment quite similar to the one that Bugs has with Neo, which is that she... I don't know if she was on top of a building. I don't know where she was, but she locked eyes with a complete stranger, with a man on the street. And that look, that exchange that they had, stopped her from doing what she was going to do. And she's talked about that man saved her life and whatever that very well be. So I do think that this stuff is all in there. Like, I don't think that this movie is not a commentary on, mm-hmm, these notions, but I also don't necessarily think it is as, you know, aggressive as some people might think it is, yeah, on that level.
Yeah.
I
mean, having gone through this myself,
sure.
So being familiar with grounding techniques and all that stuff, it in no way felt like an assault on, you know, on therapy.
If you've been to enough therapy, you know, Neil Patrick Harris is playing a terrible therapist. Well,
yeah.
He's not a very good therapist.
No, he's not.
But I do.
He's not like my therapist, Melissa. Hi, Melissa.
I think that, or my therapist, Jennifer. But
mine, Annie.
Hi, Annie.
All women. Interesting. I do think that I want to talk for a second about Neil Patrick Harris's performance and the character. First of all, calling him the analyst is brilliant, obviously. But there is something to, and if you haven't read Emily's article about resurrections and trauma, everyone should go and read it. But I think that you make really interesting points in it about not so much its depiction of therapy, but the way therapy is used metatextually and in a narrative component, the way that it's actually physically used as a narrative and a storytelling device, that I do think is pretty brilliant. So I really appreciated that.
I just kept saying, uh-huh, like I was agreeing that I'm brilliant, which
you
are,
and you should agree with it, obviously.
I think we are in this era when everything is, this is just a gloss of my article, everything is quote unquote about trauma. Yeah. And none of it really is, because it's not interested in engaging with it on the level that trauma actually takes over your life. It's like, you know what, if half of humanity disappeared because a thumb snapped its fingers, wouldn't that be really
traumatic?
And it would be, but it's such a... Like, we read about how people dealt with the Black Death, where a third of Europe died, and like they just like they totally mentally broke down. You cannot depict that in a superhero movie. So you depict like a kind of thin gloss of like, well, I, you know, things would be hard. I remember people being like The Leftovers, one of my favorite shows. Like, people being like, okay, so 140 million people disappear. People wouldn't freak out that much about that. And then you look at our responses to COVID, and people are just terrible at dealing with this stuff. Yeah. So everything is about trauma, but nothing is really about trauma. And it's a gloss. Yeah.
Can I wanted to ask you this, because I thought about it as I was reading your article, because the term trauma, which I agree with you, is thrown around in every think piece about every piece of art, the television show, movie, book, whatever.
It's not even a think piece. It's the creators coming out and being like, actually, it's about trauma.
Right. Sure. That too. I guess my point is,
every story is about trauma. Like trauma in and of itself is a giant tent, right? Definition, the way the word works, we're really talking about stakes. We're really talking about any sort of emotional fallout that comes from an event or whatever the case might be. So to your point, everything really, for all intents and purposes, could be put under the moniker of trauma. Yeah. But the things that really grapple with it, like this film, can really own it, is really what it comes down to.
Yeah. And like, I think one of the things I was thinking about is the ways in which I think this movie engages with the thought that, like, if you are constantly forcing these characters to relive like terrible things, you are essentially trapping them in a trauma spiral. Like, you know, what happens to Spider-Man in No Way Home should trap him in this terrible trauma spiral. And now we're like, well, Tom Holland's got to do a new trilogy, right? Like, why can't we just leave that character where he is? Like, I have this, because I write fiction in addition to writing criticism, I have this bad habit of, like, you know, thinking about, it's not a bad habit, it's a good thing. I think about my characters as real people. I think about, what are they going through? If I just keep forcing them through these cycles, what am I doing to them? You know?
Well, like, wouldn't you say that that's the, I mean, one of the differences between a television show and a franchise is that a television show can have a singular trauma that you can unpack over many seasons.
Yeah.
A movie has to create a new trauma every for all intents and purposes every time, which to your point makes it sort of masochistic.
You know, I love Leftovers. We talked about that. I'm obsessed with this show made by friend of the pod, some friends of the pod, Yellow Jackets.
What show might you be talking
about? Yeah, I'm fucking obsessed with it. It's all I think about. And like,
it's about trauma.
It is the only, and this is the thing in an article I wrote that got killed, but that may see the light of day elsewhere. It's the only show I can think of that is genuinely just like, it understands how trauma functions, because I think it doesn't use the word trauma until the penultimate episode of its first season. I think it never, it just is like, here's how these people were marked by this terrible experience in which their plane crashed in the woods and they became cannibals. Like God, this show's nuts. I love it.
But wouldn't you say that part of it is also baked into, unfortunately, the gender role component of it as well?
There's something about
being a woman in those circumstances is very different than being a man in the circumstances.
Yes, and it's also what's baked into it is that it is, broadly speaking, in the genre of horror, and horror deals with trauma really well. So horror and television deal with trauma really well. And so like that is a perfect melding of those two things. But movies struggle to deal with trauma because every time there's a new world-ending crisis. Mm-hmm. And like, the stakes always have to like stay sky high. You know, you look at something like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and every season she was facing a world ending crisis, but it scaled up. Yeah. You know, by the end she was fighting God, and like, cool. We all have fought God at one time or another. Sure. Let's just be honest with ourselves. Okay.
Kenny beat God.
Kenny, did you beat God?
I did actually kind of beat God. It's true. Yeah, no, that's true. I'll tell you about it. But yes.
That explains a lot of the last several years. Anyway.
It's, you know what? It was a tough fight. I'm not saying he was definitely a formidable opponent.
Does God fight dirty?
Are you kidding?
That's incredible.
Yes.
Does God fight dirty?
All right. So you're joking about fighting God aside, this does tie in a little bit to what I was about to say about why I think trauma works. It works well as an animator in TV and not so well in movies. And in general, not every movie, but in general, big movies come to a resolution.
Yes.
And the resolution is, this is how you will get over your trauma or your grief or whatever problem you have. And if the problem you have is, you know, a bully's trying to kill me, then you can get over that by killing that person first. That's a good way to move on with your life. But if the thing is, I can't get over the fact that I think this bully is that I had to kill this bully and I don't know what to do about it, there is no, you know, I found love moment that is going to answer that question. Yeah. So the reason a show like Yellow Jackets works so well is because it fundamentally understands that there is no there is no fix except for like beating God. And that's the joke of it. That's why this plays into it. Like you act like there is something so much bigger than like finding some fucking hobby to help you get over your trauma. It is a series of small things done over and over and over, and finding new small things when those small things don't work, and continuing every single day to find some other way to make yourself feel just a little bit more like you can continue. Like, and that works really well to the serialized nature of a show, and works really poorly in the, you know, love conquers all version of most movies.
Yeah.
Which I don't think, by the way, The Matrix is saying at all here that love conquers all. Mm-hmm. I think it's actually interesting that, you know, this that Neo and Trinity are almost not even characters by the end of this film.
You know, they're like a unit. They're basically just
They're a unit. They're an idea. They're, you know, two gods, essentially. Yeah. They're, you know, but they are tools being used by someone else to power a system. Totally. And that's kind of interesting, too.
The stakes, one thing I think makes this movie's depiction of trauma work is that the stakes end up being pretty small. Like, obviously, there's like, whatever, you know, are they going to be able to save it? But like, the stakes are, can Neo and Trinity figure their way out of this puzzle they're in? And that's all trauma is. And it helps if you have somebody who is also sort of figuring out what's going on alongside you. It helps if you have someone to hold your hand when you jump off the building. But like, ultimately, jumping off the building is a choice you have to make. And, you know, it's all obviously metaphorical, but like, I think that one of the reasons this movie works for me is because the stakes are small. And like, you have to scale the stakes back if you're going to reboot this franchise. And like, I don't know, how did your son feel about the swooning love story between two people in their 50s?
Well, the you know, the interesting thing about modern media is that's not that old anymore. Right. Like, this motherfucker's John Wick. So like, you know, this isn't some old man in his 50s. This guy is like very cool to a younger generation. So it was not brought up.
It is old if you're a woman, though. Like, Carrie Ann Moss isn't working that much. And like, now she's,
looks great.
That's though. True. Yeah. But that's certainly...
She's so hot.
So hot.
So hot.
So hot. I want to be clear. Yeah, everyone in this movie is hot.
Well, that's a big... And I appreciate that greatly. I love beautiful people. But he didn't seem to comment on that at all. It comes up like... That's way less a thing like than when we were younger, I think. Mm-hmm.
I think it is funny that so much of this movie is very specifically, like, you could take the core story of this movie and turn it into an Alexander Payne movie, like, with strip off all the franchise stuff and just be like, this is about two middle-aged people who find each other again and fall in love, and they have to, like, go through some therapy to do that. And it would mostly work. You know,
like, Alexander Payne's Matrix movie would be interesting.
It would work as long as the beginning trauma was some woman doing something unforgivable to Neo.
To a man.
Something so horrible to Neo, you can't believe that he can even walk after the beginning of what she does to him.
And then they all get shrunk and have to live in a bottle.
Yeah, it's perfect. Yeah.
Have I told you how much I hate Alexander Payne?
I'm not the world.
But loves election. Loves election.
Of course. I love election.
Election's great. I'm not the world's biggest. Yeah.
But everything stinks. Everything else like stinks very much.
So there's an opportunity that I want to take right now, which is a second bite at the apple of the film that we are releasing on Friday. And I want to hear your thoughts on this film a little bit, Emily, as we wrap this up. It's a big 99 film. You spoke of Yellow Jackets. We have Karen Kusama coming on for Fight Club.
I know what this is. I know what's happening right now. I'm gathering my thoughts.
And I'm so we did an episode, a Y2K episode with Sean O'Connor, a couple weeks ago. We asked him his thoughts on Fight Club as well. So, you know, we're getting a second bite at the apple with this bonus episode. And I saw a tweet that you posted a few. I think you rewatched Fight Club relatively recently, Emily, probably, if I'm not mistaken.
And it sounds like a thing I would do.
And it was a very simple tweet. It was, hey guys, Fight Club's a good movie. something along those lines. But I was wondering if you could extrapolate on that a little bit.
I don't like, so when I look at Fincher, Fincher is somebody I run hot and cold on. Fight Club is not one of my Fincher movies, but I do think it's good. I think it's the pretty classic, along with The Matrix, movie that, you know, the wrong people took the wrong way.
100%.
The thing with Fight Club is I don't think there's that other well. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, Lana and Lily coming out sort of randomly saved The Matrix.
Totally agree with
that. Lana and Lily were cis men somehow, then you would not be looking at it in a different way.
Interesting. Yeah.
The fact that they came out adds this added layer of relevance and resonance. And like, I think that helped that movie. Fight Club doesn't really have that. The one thing I think, you know, that has given it second life is it's very anti-capitalist in a way that resonates with our current moment. But it mostly presents that as anti-consumerism, which I think is interesting because consumerism and capitalism are different things, blah, 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 blah. But the end of that movie, when, you know, they blow up the buildings and Where Is My Mind plays, is, of course, you know, just this sort of stunning little sequence. I do think, you know, that movie, the elements of it that are meant to be satirical, the elements of it that are meant to be a commentary on life, the elements of it that are meant to be a commentary on toxic masculinity kind of got lost by the wayside. And the great writer Jude Doyle has sort of written about how he, you know, as a transmasculine person, reads that movie and Brad Pitt's performance in that movie, and like having this guy, this super Vero guy inside of you who's fighting to get out. And I am interested to see trans mask people kind of claim that movie as their own, which is a thing that's slowly but surely happening. And I think that will be a similar thing to The Matrix, where people get very mad about that happening for some reason. But yeah, I don't know. I like it. I think it's good. I think it's well made. I think Fincher's best movie is either Zodiac or Gone Girl. So I'm not the world's prototypical Fincher.
I'll say this. You know, first of all, you know, Karen had some tremendous insights into it, and I think that it's a great episode.
I'm so looking
forward
to
it. Kenny and I talked about this a little bit. We texted a little bit about this. Fight Club's not cool anymore. If anything, it's kind of like, I said this to Kenny, I have a beautiful Fight Club poster that I used to have on my wall that I no longer have on my wall.
You would suck.
And I remember many months ago, probably a few years ago now, quite honestly, it was in my bedroom and I moved it into another room because I was just like, you know what? I don't really want someone coming into my bedroom and seeing me with a Fight Club poster on my wall. And I think that says something. Whereas if I had a Matrix poster on my wall, a little nerdy, don't get me wrong, but I also think, to your point, Emily, it wouldn't have the same connotation. There's something icky or about Fight Club.
That is a great kind of like benchmark thing. Like, would you put the poster on your wall? Because Emily behind her right now is a fig bag poster on the wall. I do that requires no explanation. You don't need to say, well, I'm not one of those bad Fleabag fans who's only there because I like people punching each other in the face.
Sure.
Or more to the point, because I love when priests fuck.
Who doesn't,
right?
Because I think all priests should be fucking.
You got to fight God, and then you got to fuck God. Those are the two things you got to do.
And you know, similarly speaking, Phil, I believe that's a Eternal Sunshine poster.
Eternal Sunshine poster and a Punch Drunk Love poster.
Okay, those are not things that you have to explain away. Yeah. Someone comes over, and the assumption is you're just a person with good taste, and maybe runs a little more on the sentimental side. Exactly who you are, right?
I'm fine with that.
On my wall, I got a Home Alone poster.
There you go.
There you go.
Which, you know, I don't think I have to explain to anybody that it's not that I just like random violence against criminals, though I do.
You do.
But I just like...
That movie's so weird. I rewatch it. It's so weird. Do you also, do you have art from your children?
Yeah, like random stuff.
How dare.
There you go. That's nice.
Random stuff. Stuff up there.
Some boards. There you go.
Yeah. Yeah. But
I am supposed to hang up an Americans poster and a Leftovers poster. It just hasn't
happened.
But on great representations of Emily.
But I would say that, you know, I would literally never put a Fight Club poster on my wall. I would literally never put a Matrix poster on the wall because God forbid someone should think I'm a Red Pill lunatic. So I do think that, you know, Matrix has been reclaimed as the sisters came out as trans. Mm-hmm. And I think also it has blunted anybody from anybody who I believe they don't want to be embracing the movie from embracing the movie. Because then they would have to explain to their friends how, why they like the trans woman movie. So I think that there's some, you know, something there. But I think that, you know, that's an interesting little like benchmark. Would you put the poster on your wall?
Yeah, it's and I think that Fight Club is a film that, you know, Kenny and I have talked a lot about, like, you know, when we do Fight Club, we knew that it was something that we were going to do and what the take was going to be like, what the way into it is going to be, because it's just, it has aged oddly, I guess, is maybe the best way to put it. It's still a technically proficient film with great performances and a lot of really interesting ideas in it. But it is also, and I think I texted this to you, Kenny, when I was rewatching it, like, it might be the most 1999 movie in a weird way, you know, that it feels like it encapsulates all of the great and the strangeness of that year.
What I like about Fight Club, having been, you know, now we're about 2 or 3 weeks away from having done this podcast already with Karin. Mm. I like that the debates about Fight Club are still open. I like that you know, whereas I think the debates about The Matrix are kind of closed. Yeah. At this point, I think, you know, and there's been academic papers and there's been classes taught about it. And there's certainly philosophical arguments that you can have. But I don't think that, you know, the what did the Wachowskis mean when they made this movie? Yeah. I think there are definitely some ideas that we've coalesced around that feel right to most people. Yep. I think it's really interesting that The Matrix is still a very challenging text. And there is this like little gremlin when you watch it, which is like, maybe this is what they're saying. Like, is it possible that the badge is actually like text and not, or that's actually the subtext? And that's a kind of weird little kind of exciting feeling when watching a movie and because I love interest so much, wanting it to be, you know, morally and ethically right, and feel like, oh man, this isn't really driving with what I want. Like, can I contort myself? Yeah.
I think that's rad. I think I like that feeling when I'm watching a movie, when I'm like, I think maybe this movie is trying to make me hate myself a little bit.
Yeah.
But also, as a true failure of a man, who gave into the feminized culture of the time.
Oh yes, that's right.
I get to make that joke. I don't know. I'm so fascinated by that movie, and like, it's this perfect middle ground of like, The Matrix is a movie that we can still appreciate. American Beauty, largely because of who it stars, is just like, you can't ever watch it again. Fight Club.
I don't agree with that.
I mean,
it's tough on a bunch of levels.
Obviously, you can watch it. Like, I'm not saying you're forbidden.
I think it's the worst. I think it's the worst movie, and I think it has nothing to do with Spacey. I think it's the fucking Pits.
I agree that it has a lot of problems, but like the Spacey thing suddenly like made it radioactive.
Yeah.
But the Fight Club is like right in this weird middle ground where you can't entirely say what's going on there. And I'm interested in that as a critic, but I get why societally that can be weird. But yeah, you're right. It's not really cool anymore.
Well, I also think that Fincher has grown as a filmmaker in, I would argue, intellectually in leaps and bounds since Fight Club, in the sense that he's found, like, I think that the thing about Fight Club is that it's,
playfully non-committal, right? Like Fincher's clearly right. being like enjoying taking the piss out of the situation and kind of not taking a stance one way or another on a lot of stuff. Whereas he has sort of fine-tuned that skill as he's progressed as a filmmaker.
Fincher is an endlessly fascinating filmmaker mm-hmm. that almost doesn't get talked about enough. Like, I know that sounds crazy because he probably is the internet's favorite director, but there is this idea of like he's the director of film. He's the favorite director of film bros that almost gets dismissed. And there is this idea that, you know, Zodiac is its own kind of, you know, brilliant period piece that stands apart. But when you're saying that when we're talking about Fight Club not really settling the argument, the reason I love Gone Girl so much is because The Place It Leaves You is really troubling. Yeah. And it's the best. And I and Emily, I know enough about you to know that like An Amazing Amy is kind of what you want because it's kind of what I want.
That's who I want to be, Kenny.
Then maybe I should marry you because you. I want, there is just something about, there is like, the to me at least, the final conclusion of that film and maybe the novel, which I didn't read, but the film is, it's unfucking believable, which is maybe it's better. To just have some excitement, whether it's good or bad for everybody else. Maybe it's preferable.
It is the rare movie where the four chief creative people behind that, David Fincher, Gillian Flynn, Rosamund Pike, and Ben Affleck, all think they're making different movies. Yeah. Those movies are all in conversation with each other in just ways that are like I love that movie. And I hope I someday get to be on a podcast about it.
Maybe someday.
By the way, everybody look forward to, at the end of this year, there's going to be a podcast like It's 1999 Wedding Special. That's the final Ooh. Episode of 2022 because Kenny just proposed marriage to me. And we're getting married at the end of the year. It's going to be we're going to get married and we're going to discuss some celebrity wedding of 2022.
I would love that. And that would make me very happy. I've always kind of wanted that. Because I love our podcasting and this is like the foundation of a good marriage. But I don't care about my own marriage. There's nothing to do with that. happy to leave my wife for you. Yeah. But just on the Gone Girl tip, yeah. I put it on my top, I think it was in my top 10 yeah. of yeah. the past decade. It is yeah. one it's of my favorite mine. Films, mm-hmm. but what I happen to be watching Social Network. Like I'm in the middle of it right now because I'm watching it as research or something and I'm texting Phil as I do, as I watch all movies. And I think Social Network's fucking brilliant and basically perfect too. It's interesting to me, but it's not as complex as these movies we're talking about. It's really not emotionally as complex. But what I love about Social Network is it was first through the door. It was really the first piece of art that I can remember that called the internet out for what it is. Sure. That stopped lauding the technology or on the other side, basically saying it's going to kill us all on a matrix level and be like, oh, no, it's really just about titillation. Like it's really just about recreating the social structure. And it's real. And it is like a way of radicalizing the creepiest elements of our society. And it doesn't have to be. I don't even want it to be ambiguous. I don't think there's anything 10 years removed, 12 years removed, ambiguous about what Facebook has done to us. And I love that about that film.
That is the rare movie that at the time people were like, this goes a little too hard on Mark Zuckerberg. It is a great movie, but it takes him to task. And now we're like, this movie didn't go hard enough. It
did not go hard enough.
It goes pretty hard. Like, I mean, watching it, he is If you go into it with zero empathy for this guy, so you're not even trying to find the humanity in him, and you're just like, I know who he becomes, it 100% follows that through line throughout the entire movie. Everything he says is the thing an asshole would say in that moment. Mm-hmm. It's thrilling. Mm-hmm.
Can I just say one quick thing though, on the Gone Girl thing? Because as you guys were talking about it, I couldn't help but sort of put it next to Fight Club, because there are some interesting similarities between them and why I think Gone Girl is a better film than Fight Club. First of all, I think there's an argument to be made for the Palahniuk Flynn sort of lane that they both sort of exist in when it comes to sort of pop culture literature. I think that there is a Amy Dunn, Tyler Durden argument to be made to some degree or another as well as to what she brings out in, oh my God, why can't I think of Ben Affleck's character's name? Nick in Gone Girl, as Tyler brings out in, quote unquote, the narrator in Fight Club. I do think that the reason I put them next to each other is because I think that you can see that sort of the tone and the tool that Fincher was trying to do with Fight Club, and I would argue is more successful doing with Gone Girl. Now, Gone Girl is about marriage and it's much more sort of emotionally there, but both of those movies are satires, I put that in quotation marks, but they both are sort of as close to comedy as Fincher gets. And I think that there are similarities between those two things that I wouldn't have necessarily tapped into until you guys brought it up.
I just found my top 10 of the 2010s. And it's a great list, so I'm just going to read it.
Thank you.
Number one is Kenneth Lonergan's Margaret. Number two, Paul Thomas Anderson's The Master. Number three, David Fincher's Gone Girl. Number four, Celine Sciamma's Portrait of a Lady on Fire. Number five is...
Which had just come out.
Yeah. Mike Mills' 20th Century Women. Number six, The Wachowskis' Cloud Atlas. Number seven, Todd Haynes' Carol. Number eight, David Fincher's The Social Network, the only director with two in my top 10. Number nine, the Coens' Inside Llewyn Davis. And number 10, Ari Aster's Midsommar. So what a great list.
That's an excellent list. I also had 20th Century Women on mine. And I also had Social Network. But
You didn't have Gone Girl? I thought you did.
I had Gone Girl. We did, like, I think honestly our list was like top 20 or something like that.
I have 30. We can keep going.
Yeah, I mean, it was a long list. I mean, I had Phantom Thread very high on mine as well. But it's Fincher is a guy who is fascinating. I'll be there opening day or, you know, at midnight when it drops or whatever it is with, you know, whatever he makes, I'm there for. I speak for Kenny, in, you know, diving into Fight Club was a blast. And it continues to be a great film.
Just like when I kind of, you know, had like a real, you know, crisis of confidence when I had to admit to myself the Field of Dreams is my favorite movie. I had the similar one when I had to admit that Fincher is probably my favorite director. Because I don't think that either of those things are particularly cool things to say. But if I got, you know, look, if I'm being honest, that's just kind of where it lands.
He makes good shit.
And I think you are really right that you put the finger on it. For me, Fight Club has been lessened by the fact that I think Gone Girl does everything it does better.
Sure.
And I just like also it's about a lady. And like, Amy Dunn as the female Tyler Durden is just a really great way to look at that movie. And also Neil Patrick Harris
is in it to bring everything back.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was kind of his first big villainish turn.
Yeah.
And he's fantastic. He plays a villain really fucking well.
Well, because I think there's something very
too
he's
smart.
Such of a moment right now in terms of what he's able to kind of weaponize in terms of his sexuality, his Broadway chops, his comedy chops. He's got years on a sitcom, years as Doogie Howser, and then to twist that knife a little bit and show you that there's this insidious kind of quality to that stuff is interesting.
My only issue with Neil Patrick Harris in these roles is this might be too metatextual and unfair, but I am 1,000,000% confident that he's a good guy. There is something kind of thrilling about watching a Chris Walken or guy or Harvey Keitel, who, you know, seem like they might be good guys, but I cannot be 100% confident, or a Pesci, you know, that like scare that like kind of scare me in its own way. But like, he does play this really, really, like, I like Neil Patrick Harris's smarm and his superiority complex that he throws out really well. But like, I know when he gets off, when they say cut, he's best friends with everyone on set.
Well, Emily,
I kind of like Groff as the villain, though. That was unexpected. Groff.
I love, like, yeah. I loved everybody. I loved everybody.
He plays a nice guy all the time, yeah. And I don't know if he's nice.
Yeah,
like, both of them just sink their teeth into what they're doing.
Obviously, the best performance, Sibebe, wonderful big robot boy.
Well, the other thing I just want to say, cuddle, really quick, just wants really to quick, nuzzle, really quick. Yeah. Should Morpheus have been in this movie at all?
And by Morpheus, do you mean Lawrence?
Well, Fishburne? Yeah, but. No. I mean,
oh, you mean like Morpheus?
The character.
Yes.
He should have been.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. No, he died in the video game, which is why I mean, that was the logic that I've read.
That's not what I'm talking about. Okay. I'm talking about the character, Yahya, what's his name? Yahya Abdul-Mateen II plays Morpheus. Should Morpheus, the character, have been in this film at all?
Oh.
Did he provide us with anything except for one fight sequence that could have been done with anyone?
I'll say yes, and this is why I'll say yes. I think that the idea that Neo knows that Morpheus got him out of the Matrix the first time and creates another Morpheus to get him out of the Matrix this time feels logical. Mm-hmm.
Did he,
you know what I'm saying?
Did he even create him? Like,
what do you mean?
He didn't create the video games. Like, there is no first time. There's a little
modal. Well, he created the modal within. I mean, I know what you're saying, but like, he created a version of Morpheus to help him escape again.
He didn't need to.
This movie is about reincarnation on many levels. Neo and Trinity are not actually Neo and Trinity. They're resurrected versions of Neo and Trinity who are different people. And therefore, you need to present that more forthrightly with Morpheus and Smith. I think we would not be having this conversation if the third act had more of a resolution for Morpheus, which feels like why the third act feels like 20 minutes shorter.
Sure.
So too short.
I would actually piggyback on that. I'll say that there's a bunch of stuff that kind of gets, you know, sort of whisked away in the third act. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of like, why does Smith kind of do what he does? And he's like, adios. And then he's just like, okay. And there's just, there's a bunch of little things like that.
Excuse me. I just opened Twitter to find my top 30 of the 2010s. And as we were having this conversation, literally, I just got this notification. Can I screen share? Can I screen share?
Absolutely.
No, I can't. It's host disabled participant screen share. I was just followed by Lily Wachowski.
On Twitter. Wow.
On Twitter.
I'm going to take a screen cap.
Crazy.
That's send it amazing.
To y'all.
Stop.
just email it. This is the power of this podcast. The power right, of this
we, podcast. Should we leave it on that, or should yes, we absolutely. Get Emily's top 30?
This was as always a pleasure. We look forward to having you back.
Start picking out a dress
for a dress for your wedding. Yeah. We look forward to having you back for some mysterious movies later this year, which we're very excited to talk with you about, because we've not announced what we're doing just yet.
Very excited to be here to discuss those things that will happen. This is the part where I do my plugs, huh?
Yeah, please plug everything you've got.
I'm going to do, if you can read my writing at Vox, where I write regularly on film and television, and keep getting dragged back into doing that, but I talk about all number of other topics there. You can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/EmilyVDW. It's the handiest collection to all my links. I have a newsletter at emilyvdw.letterdrop.com, where it's mostly just me writing weird bullshit, but like people seem to like it.
Talking about Studio 60. That sounds
good.
I like the weird shit.
If you want to help me bolster my own intellectual property that has accidentally become a thing that people are occasionally like, we should turn that into a thing, you can listen to my podcast, Arden, which is a fictional series about two women who solve cold cases and try not to fall in love, and also is kind of an adaptation of Shakespeare plays. You can find that on podcatchers everywhere. That is the stuff I'm up to right now.
Unbelievable. As always, the queen of the Matrix, Emily Vandewerf.
The arbiter we'll of Christian of Christmas adjacency.
The arbiter. Also the arbiter of Christianity. Let's just face it. Yeah.
What's Thank Christianity? You so much, Emily. What's Christianity after I destroyed God?
Yeah, he already beat God. Can he beat God?
Well, boom. I had to resurrect God so we could continue the franchise.
But it's a different God.
Different God. This was a blast. We'll talk to you soon, Emily.
One last thing, please rate, review, and subscribe. Speaking of subscribing, check out our Patreon on all the best films of 1989, Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Fabulous Baker Boys, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, Field of Dreams, Major League, and many, many more. We are covering all the best films of 1989 with amazing guests like Joanna Robinson, Liz Hanna, Hunter Covington, Brian Cogman, David Iserson, and many, many more. All your favorite guests from our 1999 podcast are coming on to the 1989 Patreon. You can sign up for it at patreon.com/podcastlikeits1989. For only $5, you get access to all of these awesome episodes. And for a few bucks more, you get video of our 1999 episodes as well. Plus, there are other very cool tiers too, where you can even be a guest on our podcast. Please check out our Reddit as well at reddit.com/podcastlikeits. We're also on Twitter at podcastlikeits1999. We're also on Instagram at podcastlikeits1999. Thank you so much to Ernie and Will for producing our episodes, Sullivan for our social media, Jan Katas for our amazing art and theme songs. And most of all, thank you all for listening.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.